This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. My guest today is Gloria J. Brown Marshall. She is a prominent civil rights attorney, a professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and an acclaimed author whose work explores the intersection of race, law, and American history. Her books include She Took Justice, The Black Woman, Law and Power and Race and Law, and American Society, and her new book, A Protest History of the United States. Gloria J. Brown Marshall, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
I was reading your book and I said to my wife, this is the kind of book that Donald Trump would hate. And she said, well, it's a book.
And he doesn't read.
But it is the kind of book that MAGA Republicans would really object to, because they talk about how some people, like, say, Gloria J. Brown Marshall, want to make Americans feel guilty about their past, and that white people should feel horrible about American history, and that it's an anti-American kind of point of view to look at America through the lens of your book, A Protest History of the United States. How would you respond to that?
Well, my book has 8 chapters. And I begin with the indigenous and their resistance to the invasion of Europeans. I then go into slave uprisings and labor movements, because I believe that creating a labor union is protest. I look at women and what women were doing in the 1800s. And these are not just Black women. These are different women, most of them white. I also look at the interests of, you know, people generally who were protesting and anti-war movements in the Vietnam War, and then go through the protests against violent policing and in with climate change. And climate change is not just a Black issue. And so when I think about my book, this is the first time I've written a book that was not from a Black perspective or perspective of people of color, because my book, Race, Law, and American Society, is not just about African Americans. It's about many different people of color and their legal battles throughout the 400-year history of this country. So I would say feeling guilty is a personal feeling that's triggered when people believe there's something that's happening that's wanting to make them feel shameful. Now, is the history shameful? Some of it is. But our relationship with our country is like any other relationship. We take the good and the bad. And so what we are doing, which I think is somewhat infantile when we come to MAGA, is wanting to only look at some good. And a lot of that good is a myth. I mean, the fact that people are still believing that our country began with the Pilgrims, when the country actually began in Virginia in 1607, and the Pilgrims didn't land until 1620. So there's so much that we've put into a myth for this country that we're old enough now to know that the Tooth Fairy didn't exist, Santa Claus did not give us these rights, and we should be mature enough as a nation celebrating 250 years to come to grips with what our past is. Other countries have. Why are we continuing to be adolescent about, you know, where the nation began and what the nation did to become a nation?
Well, I'd like to look deeper into this Tooth Fairy thing, but let's put that aside for a minute. So you have a broad definition, Gloria J. Brown Marshall, a broad definition of protest. I mean, in some case, you're saying just existing is a form of protest.
Yes, if you think about it, and I'm just going to use this topic because it's a deep one. In the time period of enslavement, to live throughout that brutal period, to just survive, is an act of protest. When people are enacting genocidal policies and laws against the indigenous people, survival physically and survival of their culture, language, all of that religion is an act of protest, saying, I'm not going to let you forcibly assimilate me. I'm going to stand up for who and what I am. I'm going to speak my language. And so those are acts of protest. And that's why I had to expand the definition, because I had to be able to include Rosa Parks not giving up her seat along with the people in Black Lives Matter. How can we have both of those things exist as protests if I don't expand the definition? And then I started the book off as in a way to give a legal argument, because my background is legal history. How can I give a legal argument on behalf of protest? And I thought, not every protest is going to have a legal case associated with it. So once I started to look at protests not in a legal, strict lens, and began to look at protests more generally, I began to see that we have so many forms of protest. The sit-ins, for example, that took place during the civil rights movement, many of those sit-ins may have had arrest records connected with them, but they didn't have the types of cases we think of that give rise to U.S. Supreme Court decisions as other civil rights cases did. So I felt it was necessary to expand protest to include, yes, survival when a person is the target of genocidal policies is an act of protest.
Well, what about the protesters on January 6th who were protesting the false election of President Trump and therefore stormed the Capitol? I mean, that was a legitimate form of protest, yes or no?
I've been asked that question, and I usually say this: in their minds, they might have been thinking about protest, but then we can say the Ku Klux Klan is protesting.
Right.
And the Ku Klux Klan is protesting desegregation. So people in their own minds could be thinking about their acts as protests, but is someone who decides to stalk their ex-wife because she got a divorce, is that an act of protest that she's left him in the marriage? You know, when we start expanding protests, is lynching an act of protest? Because people want to make sure that in their minds, this is a way to delineate their way of life so that other people aren't supposedly diluting it. When we get to acts of violence, people can claim it as protest, but then at the other side of that is the criminal consequences. And in my book, I'm looking at more the look of social justice movement forward for the country. And so my protest is within those parameters. But people can include what they want in their mind as protest. But when it comes to January 6th, pay the price for it. Because that's what Black Lives Matter people did. That's what happens during the Civil Rights Movement. The people during the anti-Vietnam War movement, they paid criminal consequences for their protests. So I find it cowardice that people want to believe they were in a legitimate protest, but then don't want to pay the price for that protest, with having an arrest record and paying the price for brutalizing the Capitol and doing the things that they did. If that's an act of protest and they believe it is, they can claim it as protest, but also stand up and be man enough and woman enough to claim the consequences of your protest as well.
What about the weathermen and violence on the left?
And that's why I said, if there's going to be an act of protest that includes violence, and then the weathermen paid the price. Many of them were incarcerated and paid the price for their protest. Protest, for the most part, has involved violence. And that's why the nonviolent protest was so unique, because not only did they enter the protest with the intent of not doing violence, but they also, part of their philosophy, that they would not respond with violence. That's a nonviolent protest. Violence has always been a part of protest historically. And I would say that and if it wasn't an act of violence, physical violence, then there are other types of muted violence, someone losing their jobs or threats to that person, assaults slung at them, the racial epithets. There have been ways in which people are incarcerated. And so if you expand the idea of violence, then you can expand it to many things. But when people create violence during the protest, the expectation is that there's going to be some type of consequence. And it could be that they're given a summons, or it could be full incarceration. But unfortunately, too many times the criminal justice system has been used against the left, because you don't see cases for over thousands of people who have been lynched. You don't see their criminal cases. You don't see those people prosecuted. As you saw with January 6th, the same exact things happen. These criminal acts take place in their idea of some social protests in their minds against some idea that some white power or privilege or superiority is being threatened. And they act with violence without criminal consequences. And that has been a major part of history, with the confidence that they're not going to pay a criminal price because they're standing up for something within the community that they're supposed to be supporting.
I was around for the 1960s protests against the war in Vietnam, and a lot of that had to do with the draft, and a lot of young people were being drafted and forced to fight. And when the draft ended, a lot of the protest ended as well. I mean, there was still protest, but I think it accelerated a little around Watergate. But generally speaking, the end of the draft in 1972 or 73 kind of ended the student movement and the protest movement. And I think today when I go to see No Kings protests, things like that, the majority of protesters are not young college students, but mostly people my age, 30. And and so I wonder about your book and about the lack of interest in protest today. I don't see college campuses, even though they are directly affected by the current administration. You know, I don't see a huge amount of young people protesting. Is that part of why you wrote your book, or what are your thoughts about that? Or maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I'll push back in this way. College campuses were very much a hotbed of protest around the Gaza war. And you saw college campuses, whether or not my campus, part of the other campuses at City University of New York, Columbia, of course, became a hotbed of protest to the point where, and Harvard, to the point where it was like, you know, became a goal of this presidency to undermine the administration of Columbia, to get information on the students who were protesting. There are Harvard students who didn't graduate because they had participated in protests, and protests were taking place in the University of California system and in many other major systems as well around that particular issue of the war in Gaza and the starvation of the children and other people there. So it depends on the issue. There are younger people who are starting to be attracted to the No Kings protest. I will say that the student movement didn't end. It shifted. Movements happen because people feel a personal value at stake, or someone close to them is in a dire situation, or they see, even if they don't know the people, that their values, their community values, are at stake. When we had the war in Vietnam, the idea that the government was lying, that people were coming home in terrible condition if they came home at all, the media was actually showing, as you and I might remember, I was a baby at the time, but you didn't have to laugh that hard. Okay. That, you know, the caskets coming off of the plane. We remember those things, and they made a difference. And when you have people who are being drafted, relatives and others, that's the other thing about the draft, even though it was still unfair in many ways, it did, because it skewed to the poor, it did include people of middle class and upper middle class backgrounds. So there was a shared interest in what the war was doing and the people who were not coming home. I think there's been this disconnect intentionally when it comes to many people in the media for this particular war. I think there is an interest, because how did we end up in this way, you know, end up in another war this quickly? And people don't understand why we're, you know, fighting with Iran. But there's no draft. And so you can't, you can't say there's no interest, but since there's no skin in the game, it goes back to what I said before about values. When will it prick the values that will make people feel I've got to say something because this is wrong? And even though if it's not my family, it's a value that I hold dear that I think is in jeopardy and I must speak up. And war does that, when, especially now that we start to see, you know, the bodies coming in.
Yesterday, I heard President Trump talking about Elvis Presley, and he said he hadn't ever met Elvis Presley, but maybe he should tell a little lie and say that he had, as if what an absurd thing that the president could tell a little lie when we all know that this administration is the least truthful. I don't know if I've said that correctly grammatically, but and here I am talking to you, Professor, but. There's a lot of falsehoods and alternative facts that have been very pervasive in the last 10 years. And so how can, through protest or school or whatever, how can we let Americans know the truth when the upper echelons of our government is erasing truth?
Then that's been the case from the very beginning of our nation. The idea that the indigenous people were savages, and the books that would come out and other placards and, you know, showing even of the cowboys and Indians up until the 1960s and early 70s was that, you know, painting this picture of the indigenous in a way in which other people wanted them to be in order to placate the feelings of what could be called guilt. Or I have to face the history of the nation. When it comes to slavery, the idea was to say, even to this day, oh, it was a work release program, a work program where, you know, the enslaved were here to learn skills, and which was a total lie because, you know, people who were enslaved were actually targeted for the skills they had in Africa so that those skills, farming or artisan work or whatever they were doing, could be used in the United States and profited by people here. With the idea of the lies they were told about women, and that women didn't have the mental capacity to vote, and they should just be wholly dependent like children. All of these lies have been part of propaganda that's taken place in not just the United States, in many other places. And so it's only been probably in the last 20 years, especially the last 15, that we've had books come out that speak to what really happened in the nation's history that are being read beyond the people in that particular affected group. So you have people who are African-American writing about this nation, as I did, and you have people who are not African-American reading the books. And so I don't think it bothered people as much, those who are bothered, when the books stayed within the communities, when women wrote books, you know, about Gloria Steinem and others about the women's movement and the oppression of women, as long as other women read it. But when it started to be read by people outside of the affected group, I think that's where this sense of, oh, my children are feeling uncomfortable. Like, I'm not supposed to be made to feel uncomfortable about anything. And I had a chance to speak to the Coast Guard at Coast Guard headquarters. And what that question was asked about, why is all this happening now? And simply, people lost their jobs. People were brutalized. People were stalked when they wrote things that were negative about this country. Because this country, as I said in my book, has the United States, which is the empire builder, bully mentality. And it also has the mentality of, you know, freedom and liberty. But freedom and liberty for whom? And so to be able to write the truth, to be able to have different people read the truth, especially young people read the truth about their country, is empowering to those people, but is also very frightening for those who want to hold dearly to the myth and believe in white superiority and that they didn't do anything wrong. And if they did anything wrong, it was for a just cause. And so it doesn't matter, and not have to come to grips with the ancestral line is a path that's bloodstrewn. And it is not just our nation, but we have to figure out why people protested in the first place. Because there was a sense of a promise made or a sense that people have a personal humanity that was not being recognized, whether or not they were laborers. And that's why I said it's not a, this a Black perspective book, because it's about the labor unions. And I went down to coal country, West Virginia, drove down there. You know, those were not Black people, majority of them, in those coal mines. When you talk about the women's movement, those were not just people of color who were women who were protesting for the right to vote. The Vietnam War movement involved different people of color, but those majority led white movements about the Vietnam War and other war movements. So this country has complex history, and we need to just be mature enough to read about the protests, even police officers. And I'll in this part, if you don't mind, with the police unions. Whenever I hear police officers saying, oh, these people are protesting, they're un-American, police officers protested to create their union. There are people who died to create the police unions. And when they have the contract in and they don't have a new contract, they protest for a new contract. So they use protest as they would. And people, as I said before, people use protest and the idea of who's supposed to protest. And Martin Luther King said that many people in the civil rights movement had to protest for the right to protest. So these ideas within the Constitution seem to be limited by some to some. And if people cross the line and say, I have constitutional rights too and a right to protest, there, that's when the violence is triggered. Too often the violence is triggered.
We're talking with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and she has a new book. It's called A Protest History of the United States. And Gloria J. Brown Marshall has trashed the Tooth Fairy, and now she's telling us that George Washington could, in fact, tell a lie. So let's go back at the beginning of your book. I mean, your book is really a history of the United States with the through the lens of protest. And even before the United States, because your book starts in colonial times or even pre-colonial times, you talk about how the Native Americans had 1,000 years of existence here on this continent before the Pilgrims arrived. Oh, wait, it wasn't the Pilgrims. It was those other guys. So talk a little bit about I don't think you believe that the country shouldn't exist, but what mistakes were made in the founding of our country?
When we think about the founding of the country, if we go back to that initial history in 1607, that the English were part of the business of expanding the empire into the New World. And that business was one in which there would be a colony in the New World. That's what we were called, North and South America, especially North America, the New World. And so if the Old World extended into the New World, they had to have a business or some type of crop, something. It wasn't for just exploration. They wanted a business arrangement. And so that ship in 1607 held at the top of the ship, those people who were the elite, the people who were to carry out the business arrangement for the charter that was given by King James. But those people below deck were looking for a new chance, an ability to start fresh, because the caste system within the Old World would have prevented them from ever rising up from the serf levels that they were at the time. So there were two different ideas in the very beginning that were clashing, that were in conflict. The mercantile idea, the idea of the business arrangement, which I say is the United States empire builder mindset, and the idea of liberty and freedom, and that would be those people below deck. What went wrong is that we never had one clear vision of what this country would be. It was the idea that we're going to take from the people who were there, not live with them, not live among them, not be a part and share. No, we're going to take over this landmass. And in taking over this landmass, we are going to now imprint the European ways upon the people there. And if they don't like it, they can die. So the bloodshed that began from the very beginning with the mindset of superiority was one that was false. So instead of accepting that the Angolan Africans, who were those who arrived, the 20 and odd Africans in 1620 from Angola, had their own government, They had their own culture. They had their own currency. They had their own art. They had their own civilization. The Powhatan indigenous people had their own government. There was Chief Powhatan. So that meant they had a government. They had people within their government. They had their own currency, their own art. In order to live together would be a respect for the people as people, as human beings, that they have had their own, carved out their own place in the world. Instead, there was this mowing down of anybody who didn't believe in the European superiority. And those are the elite European superiority. Not, they didn't believe the people in the bottom of the boat were, of the ship were superior over the people at the top. And so this brutality that took place, and then ignoring the brutality, does to fly the flag of liberty while brutalizing millions of people, is the schizophrenia that becomes the basis of America that we're still dealing with right now. Where we went wrong, let's not say we're about liberty and justice if we're actually brutalizing people. There are many other nations that did similar things, not to the extent the United States did, to be this level of an experiment. They don't fly the flag of liberty and justice for all. They're not saying that they are a democracy on a shining light on the hill of democracy. They're not putting themselves out in this way. This nation decided that despite everything it had done to so many people for so long, that it was still going to be this symbol of liberty, justice, and democracy without having to stop and think, how are you going to be one thing when you're doing something else? And I think that's one of the issues, that whether or not somebody's in MAGA or whether or not they're, you know, believing like Donald Trump, you know, wants to believe in his mind, that they can just ignore history and it'll go away, because we, once again, have the power to determine who's right, they are, who's wrong, those others. And we write the history and we say it long enough, then our voices will be loud enough to drown out everyone else's. And for over 400 years, that is not going to happen. And that's why I said it's a matter of maturity, that people are going to rise up and say, that is not history. That is not what happened. We have the evidence of what happened. And it, even if they keep undermining books, banning books, firing people, you know, there is going to be those who rise up. They rose up when they had nothing. That's why I protest history of the United States, that what I got from it, people who had no rights under law still rose up. You cannot stop the voices of people and pretend they don't exist. And that's a lesson this country refuses to learn. And it was beginning to learn. And then we always get to that crossroad and too often decide that we're going to go take the road of ignorance and take the road of oppression and blindness and say we're not going to pay attention to these other people in this country. We've been a diverse country since 1619. We had all those diverse people from England, from Ireland, from Scotland, from, you know, we had the Dutch. Then the Africans arrived in 1619. The Powhatan were already there. So we've been a diverse country since 1620. But the diversity refuses to be something that we embrace and accept. And that's the problem. The oppression of other people's voices, the classism to try to defeat those who have less and build on their backs and not give them their voices. And the idea that we want to ignore that this is a diverse country. It has been a diverse country since the first 20 years of its existence, 20 years and less of this existence. And that diversity is going to remain. And those people in those diverse groups are not just going to sit back and have oppression roll over them and pretend they don't exist.
So to what degree do you think the current administration is a reaction to the fact that Barack Obama had been elected president?
I think it's a direct example, but this is also the ego of Donald Trump, because not all of those people who are capitulating to Donald Trump were actually in that same mindset that they so opposed Barack Obama, they would do these heinous things to their own country. They want to maintain their political power. And then we have the evangelicals. And religion has played a role also from the 1600s, because those people who were indigenous and those people who were African when they did attempt to become Christian, the idea was they don't have souls, or that God told them they are supposed to labor for life. So they the use of God, especially in Christianity, to oppress people is longstanding, and also to pretend to have a sense of superiority. I have had the opportunity to go to the Vatican archives, not to the Vatican itself. I've been to the Vatican before, but to actually do research in the Vatican archives, which is very difficult to do, to have that access. And when you see the role of the Catholic Church, of the Pope, and giving Portugal, which is the beginning of the slave trade, not England, but giving Portugal the right to enslave those people who are non-Christian. So this idea of religion and racism has been a part of the fabric of not just this country, but many other countries. So to have evangelicals, you know, join forces with Donald Trump to support him, who I've never even heard him say he was a Christian, but, you know, when he stood in front of the church with the Bible upside down after terrorizing peaceful protesters, it made me wonder what religion he actually practiced, if any, Satan. But the thing that, I think the real concern I have is that the use of power to oppress those voices that are in opposition goes squarely against what the framers of the Constitution wanted. And so whether or not they're laborers, women, people of color, the Constitution has now been applied to all, and therefore the voice of the people, whether or not it's going to be recognized, is going to be a voice that's not going away anytime soon.
Well, we're talking with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and her new book is called A Protest History of the United States, and it's a very rich and textured volume that I highly recommend. With religion, with respect to religion, so slaveholders believed that they were doing a positive good for slaves because they were savages in Africa, and therefore by capturing them and enslaving them, they were giving them a ticket to heaven because they also taught them about Jesus and religion. So religion supported what they were doing.
I have to say that's quite false.
Yeah.
Slavery is about greed. And when I teach about slavery, if you put race to the side, and you say, if you could work someone for free for life, and that was the law, would you do it? And how many of us have had jobs where if we could be worked for free, then the person would have worked us for free? And most people raise their hands. Now, whether or not it's the job they're in right now or the one they had during high school or college, but they know that if they could have been worked for free, or they were worked and they knew that they were supposed to get more money and they weren't, you know, all of this is about greed. Slavery was about greed. How can I have people work for me and not pay them? And then what rationale can I use so why I don't feel guilty? Well, God said, based on, you know, the different books of the Bible, sometimes it's Cain, sometimes, you know, you hear about why these people should be worked for free for you. Not that you should be worked for free, but these people should be worked for free. And then they have law and violence to uphold this belief. So slavery is about greed. And then the racism and the other xenophobia is the use of rationalization so that people don't feel guilty about what they're doing to another human being. You know, was slavery a work program that benefited the enslaved? No, because as I said before, those people who were the slaveholders would go to particular parts of Africa and have those people with particular skills. As I said, farming, remember the tobacco crop was a crop that became the gold mine of the colonial time period, tobacco. Tobacco is very labor intensive. There weren't enough indentured servants or white slaves, as they were referred to sometimes, to continue to do the labor needed to be brought over by those ships. And plus those particular people, the indentured servants, were actually protected by the laws of Parliament. And so those people who were not protected, the indigenous and the Africans. And so to say God said this because of the Pope, Pope Nicholas, that's why I said I went to the Vatican archives to study this. Pope Nicholas had a papal creed, and this was like they call it a papal bull, P-A-P-A-L, bull, B-U-L-L, two separate words. And this decreed that Portugal could take over any land they found of those people who were basically heathens or non-Christians, and then use that land and any proceeds from that. Then, of course, the church gets a cut. Okay. So, yeah, so now you have greed at this basis. And in order to expand empires, you need money. Where's the money coming from? It's coming from the products from those enslaved people. So this was a commercial enterprise that, and overlaid on the commercial enterprise was this sense that they were following some edict from God that allowed them to rape and pillage and torture and maim and kidnap people from other lands and then believe or want to believe that they are doing something good. As a matter of fact, since they believe that the Africans nor the Africans nor the indigenous had souls in their minds. So that even when they were baptized into Christianity, since they said, oh, they don't have souls and it's against their Christian belief to enslave another Christian. So these people having been baptized and said, oh, we're saved. Let's just say they don't have souls. That way they can still be baptized into Christianity, but they're not considered Christians. And we can continue to enslave them and make money off of them. Because if you had to actually pay them some of the profit, oh, then you would have to make less money. And we don't want to make less money. We want to make all money. And I also say to my students, if you had someone who would clean your room while you're gone, cook your meals, wash your clothes, do all these things, and then you can rape them at night and there's no criminal consequence. What do you think about that? And they'll go, wow, especially the guys. Well, I don't know about rape, but, you know, then I said, okay, what if that's your sister? What if that's your mom? What if that's your father? People want the greed of slavery. We want the country built on slavery, but we don't want to acknowledge the greed, the rape, the murder that took place. And so when the enslaved rose up, which is in my second chapter, and that is protest, protesting against the enslavement, protesting against the rape, protesting against the diabolical nature of the debauchery of human bondage. And that is a human being saying, you may not see me as a human being, but I do. And I see beyond the God you're preaching to a deeper God, and that is far beyond what you're doing, that's narrowed down to make God a part of your beliefs that allow you to do this. So even the debate around God has been one in which you have the African Americans saying that God is one thing and the whites saying that it's something else, that God that allows them to torment another whole, you know, millions of people from a whole continent and others of color is not the God we believe in. So that sense of religion and the debate over God, it was Denmark Vesey who said God told him to rise up, you know, in South Carolina to lead a slave insurrection. It was John Brown who said God, you know, said that slavery is wrong, and that's why he led the raid on Harper's Ferry. And Nat Turner said it was God sending him a sign of an eclipse that said this is the time for the rise up. So God has been a part of debate when it comes to protests. Whose side is God on? Everybody's praying that God's on their side, but, you know, God hasn't said yet what's whose side he's on. But I think religion is not as cut and dried as people might think, that, you know, the Christians gave religion, because there were religious beliefs already on the continent. In Africa, there were religious beliefs already practiced by the indigenous as well.
I always think it's interesting at the end of a game when the team thanks God for letting them win. It's like, thank God for making the other teams lose. But Gloria J. Brown Marshall, the protest by indigenous peoples against Manifest Destiny was unsuccessful. That is, they were mostly all killed or put on reservations or whatever. I mean, today they still exist, but not not to the degree that they had wanted, but slavery has ended, and the civil rights movement was largely successful. So why was one protest more successful than the other?
Well, first, you know, indigenous people have a strong population that, you know, as I said, survival is protest. And to have the full brunt of oppression without rules of engagement is something that the indigenous faced. The brutality, the cruelty of Europeans. And that's, I think, what we don't really want to discuss is, you know, the brutality and debauchery that took place on the part of Europeans. And for the indigenous to take that full front from, and for 100 years, I think, not only, and of course the treachery as well, because they have treaty after treaty after treaty, which lie after lie after lie, you know, and have the, indigenous actually try to believe and work with and stand up against, the type of firefighting, gunfire, I'm trying to think of, the use of weaponry, the way the Europeans decided to use it, and on the African continent as well as on North American continent, is unfathomable. So I don't think the indigenous lost. I think that their existence today, with their languages, with their culture, is a victory. When you look at the debauchery and the total horror that they were facing, I think that when it comes to enslavement, once again, you know, yes, there was an idea of victory that slavery ended, but what did it take? A civil war. And people claim that it's a war for states' rights, the state's right to enslave other people. That's what the state's rights, you know, issue, you know, came to be. And I remember being at the college when I was first there, I was like on the tenure track, and I had this conversation with an older white professor who turned beet red when I said this, you know, the Civil War was about slavery. No, it was not. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, and then he just stormed off, and I was like, how could we both have such different viewpoints on this? He never came back to talk to me about it, even though a few weeks later he was very nice to me. Maybe he read something to indicate that perhaps I had a point. But it's still something that, you know, people don't want to say, that if you're believing in the states' rights viewpoint from that time frame, you want to believe in a greed and a level of debauchery that was also in that time frame. That's what, when we talked about, as you said in an earlier question, what it is that we got wrong. We don't want to own the mistakes. We don't want to learn from them. We don't want to see them as they are, what happened during that time period, and try to do better. When I've had a chance to visit Norway and Sweden, and they will tell you they had a vicious history. When you talk about the Vikings and some of the things the Vikings did, and how many of their leaders were assassinated and, you know, in brutal ways, where it's like, when they say cut down, they literally cut them down. It's like, and then slice them up. And they recognize that is our history. We can't say it didn't happen. It did happen. We have to learn from it. Even if you think about it, you know, the history of Italy and the brutality of what in the early days of Italy, all we have to do, and it sounds simple, and maybe it's simpler in my mind than it is for other people, acknowledge this happened and what can we learn from it. So I don't think, when we talked about even the civil rights movement, the indigenous movements, and the movements that took place during slavery, pure victories are not exactly what happened. Progress is what happened. And the progress in which people survived the heinousness of the time and actually pushed the country forward. But we're always in fear of being pushed back. And that's where we are right now. Because protest is, and that's why I'm trying to get people to see in my book, A Protest History of the United States, it's two steps forward and one step back, because the other side doesn't want the history or the future that one side is saying. And the other side, say it's MAGA or anybody else, they're going to say, but that's not the country I want. So they're going to plan and they're going to protest and they're going to do what they want for their vision of the country. And they're going to push that. So when I hear people say, I can't believe we're protesting for women's rights. I did that when I was young. Why are we doing this again? Because the people who have a different vision of women's rights are going to be plotting and planning and figuring out how to protest for their vision of the nation. And so there's always going to be this extra conflict and push and pull, and especially the overlay of what is this country? Is it empire builder? Is it about freedom? And because that's all in the mix as well, it's very complex when we move forward. But for those three movements that you've set forth, I would say progress was made in all of them, and the cost was very high, and none of it is going to be set in stone.
When the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, I think that was the first time that the Supreme Court took away a right rather than granted a right. Maybe they've done that before, but that's the first time I remember it happening. So talk a little bit about the current court and the women's movement, if you would.
The current court is one that's conservative, and once again, religion is playing a role. We have this majority of Catholics on the court. And Justice Alito was caught saying to a group in New Jersey, I will not forget you. You know, and this is stunning because these U.S. Supreme Court justices are supposed to go to the court and will come to the court in, with blinders on as far as their own personal beliefs, even though they're human beings and those beliefs are going to shift in, and as it did with Justice Antonin Scalia many times. Who was also Catholic and Italian, and had this sense that, he was brilliant and no one else was. And that he knew exactly what the country needed. And you have these people who actually believe they know exactly what the country needs, and they will then infuse that into their decisions. So when it comes to the women's movement, back in Seneca Falls in 1848, and that wasn't the earliest meeting of women who wanted to fight for their rights, but that's the one that's been considered the anchor of the women's movement. To go forward in upstate New York from Seneca Falls, the idea of the right to vote, the Tempest movement, which was a splinter movement that said that it was alcohol that was undermining the family, and so we're going to focus our women's movement on alcohol and trying to create prohibition to stop all people from drinking. Others wanted to focus on the labor movement. So it was a splintered movement from the very beginning. Some, you know, as they went forward after the Civil War and the idea that Black men were going to gain the right to vote in 1870, some within that women's movement said, I would rather cut off my arm than have Black men vote before white women do. Some white women decided in the suffragist movement that they were going to support slavery during that time period because they wanted to gain the support of the Southern white women. And then after the war, they were in a sense of where should we go from here? But the bodily autonomy of women, their uterus has always been a part of war. It's always been a part of empire building. It's been a part of debate. It's been a part of inheritance. When you think about England, you think about any royal line, you think about who's going to be born to this king, who's going to be the next leader. So the sense of the womb is one that is always playing this major role, but nobody really talks about it. So in my book, in my women's chapter, I wanted to focus more on the womb and the battles under law that have taken place, that women had to be a part of a major lawsuit that went to the U.S. Supreme Court just to have the pill, just to practice. These are married people who, you know, Margaret Sanger, you know, whether or not you could send contraceptives through the mail, you know, in federal legislation that would prevent that. There's this idea of nationalism that we don't have enough white babies because this country was artificially made, in which they imported Europeans to create a white country, did the best they could to limit the population of people of color, and still doing that with incarceration for African Americans, deportation for Latinos, and other ways to limit the population of people of color, that white womb becomes essential. The African American womb, of course, was essential during slavery to make more slave products that were needed to make slaveholders wealthy to create the products like cotton, like tobacco and other products that were bought and sold on the Wall Street stock market. But after slavery, that Black womb then became this kind of critical issue of what should we do with these Black people? We don't need them anymore for labor the way we did before. And we don't want the number to grow so much that they can somehow find their own footing in this country. So that womb has been debated in many ways. And when we get to where we are now with Roe versus Wade, the idea that a woman should have autonomy over her own womb was something that was always frightful for some people in the country, because women should be, you know, the rib of men. And because that womb represents the continued white population, but others based on the religious beliefs that they believe that, you know, human beings began at conception. So it could be any different ways and many more that created the backlash against a woman's right to choose. But the arguments had been going on for centuries. And the idea that a woman was more than her womb, that she would have an education, that she has a mind, that she can contribute to society. These things are quite recent, over the last 50 years, 40 years. So the backlash is one that some had said as soon as Roe versus Wade was decided, there were people who began to meet to decide how they could undermine it. And then they became successful with theirs. But once again, as I said, it's two steps forward, one step back for all these movements. You make progress, you go forward, but there's always going to be another group saying, that's not the vision I have. I'm going to rise up, protest against it, and come up with my own vision. So there are people now pushing back against the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, and then they too will have their time. And that's why I think when folks really, and anybody who's listening, wherever you are, if you think what you're protesting for, whether you're MAGA or whether you're progressive, the idea is it's not going to be set in stone. And Thomas Jefferson said that the price of freedom is vigilance. And that's what I want people to understand with my book, that you can't sit on the sidelines and think that it's just going to happen the way you want to happen and stay that way once it does.
We're talking with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and the book she's talking about is called A Protest History of the United States. So how do you see us going forward? Do you see what does the future look like to you?
The future is one that is going to have more conflict, and we're going to have to go through more conflict before we get to the other side. This is a diverse country. We've got to actually look at our democracy, look at our diversity, and figure out the rights of what we want as Americans. What rights and protections do we want? And we've sliced this up so many times throughout our history, where certain people are supposed to have rights and protections and other people are supposed to have crumbs from the table of justice. And I think as long as we are still acting in these very selfish ways and being naive to our own history, those people who will do anything to maintain their superiority will do anything. And that's what I'm concerned about, because my history, my study of our American history has shown that this is a violent country that's violent by nature. I begin the book that way. This country began with violence. It's the 250th anniversary of our violent beginning. The Declaration of Independence is a protest document. And the people who then had to fight against England, because England said, we are not leaving. And so we began in violence with the Revolutionary War, and we continue to have violence. And the fact that we could be in Iran war right now, that no one saw a month and a half ago, for the most part, that we would be, as regular people anyway, that we would be in a war with Iran, means that this country is so attuned to violence that it will try, especially this administration, I fear, to use violence to maintain its course. Because it has just so much in its mind to lose to have a democracy, a true democracy with a diversity of citizenship that's recognized. And I'm quite concerned about that. I'm concerned, because our own federal resources are being used against our people. And you pointed out before was, you know, the election of Barack Obama for two terms, part of this. Yes, it's part and parcel, but it's also, the rise that he signified of people of color, particular African Americans, to rise economically, to rise socially, to rise politically, and to be in a position to judge white people. This is something that has been fought against for many years in this country. During the 1700s, 1800s, into the early 1900s, no person of color could sit in judgment of anyone white. So now we have people of color who are in these very powerful political positions, like Ketanji Brown Jackson, and this in the sense of some people, and it's the size is actually very small, who cannot accept that people of color are in these positions of power, and they would rather have them lose their jobs in the federal government, be undermined, have their stories banned in books. They would rather have that happen than to have anything put a shadow on their sense of white superiority. And I remember former Ambassador Andrew Young saying to me that racism is a mental illness. And, you know, if you think about it, that somebody is not supposed to have what they have. Someone is not supposed to be in positions of authority or power because of the color of their skin. They're not supposed to be able to judge another group of people just because they're a person of color. When you think about all that, you think maybe it was a mental illness at some point when it was so deeply embedded. But now I'm beginning to wonder if it's not still a mental illness, that white superiority, that mindset of white superiority is a mental illness, not just racism, but the idea that one is by nature superior to everyone else. I think to me, that might be the mental illness, and that mental illness can lead to violence in order for it, this myth to be maintained. And that's my concern about the future. But I also know that the people in this country are not going to just sit back and allow this authoritarian dictatorship that's taking place to continue, that they're going to step up. I wish more leaders would rise up and those people in leadership positions would actually find the fight inside of them to come up with a plan of action, because that's what I found in my book, A Protest History of the United States, that when the violence happened, and it happened in so many of these places, whether the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, the women's movement, and even the unions, as I said, in creating these unions, there was a plan of action on the position in among those who were the leaders of the movements, of the protest movements. I'm concerned about the lack of plan of action. I'm concerned about the lack of leadership, and I'm concerned about the lack of diversity in some of these progressive movements, because that diversity is needed. We need the institutional knowledge of those people who protested before, and we need those folks who are standing on the sidelines to realize you may not have wanted to be in a fight, but you're in one. And now what are you going to do? And that's where protest and disruption, and I'm not saying violence, I'm saying disruption. I'm saying the rallies are fine, but now we're to the point where there's got to be a plan. There's got to be a strategy. It's got to be long term. We have to see our resources and we have to be creative. And that's what I learned from my view of 500 years of protest history.
Well, we've got a valuable resource in your book, and it's called A Protest History of the United States. And the author, my guest, Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Gloria J. Brown Marshall, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. I appreciate it.
Power to the people.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.